Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. It's the first hour of our Friday show, the time that we virtually always have Congressman Bernie Sanders on, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number, toll-free from all across the United States. Bernie loves to take your calls. Our number, 866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives, now running for the United States Senate, is an independent from the great state of Vermont. His website, Bernie.org, which I also recommend you check out and put on your regular places to visit list, because it's a great source of news and information. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Bernie, in the old Superman comics, when I was a kid, there was this thing called Bizarro World, where everything was inverted. You know, good was bad, up was down, everything was backwards. It seems to me, from looking at what's happened in the House of Representatives in particular, but the Senate as well this week, that you guys have entered into bizarre.
Haven't heard it phrased exactly that way, but that sounds about right. What is interesting and really quite amazing about what last week was about is the very clear political goal of the Republican leadership to appeal to their base by coming up with some whole lot of agenda items which were completely irrelevant to the vast majority of the American people and only served the purpose of rallying the right-wing base. So let's talk, and then I want to contrast that to a recent report that came out from the Economic Policy Institute. Listeners should know that the EPI, based in Washington, is one of the important economic think tanks in America. If you really want to know what's going on to the middle class and working families in America, you might want to check it out.
So these guys, EPI.org, by the way, is their
that's
website.
That's right. And they're publishing a book basically called The State of Working America, or State of Working America 2006-2007. They talk about the reality of American life. Then you have the Republican leadership off talking about appeals to their right wing. We start off at a time when the middle class is shrinking, and the EPI makes a point that we spend far more for health care for any per person than any other country on earth, and yet we have 46 million Americans without any health insurance. What is the Bush administration and the Republican leadership talking about? They're talking about a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. That is their top priority. Meanwhile, the EPI is in their book publishing the fact that the United States has the highest rate of poverty. 17% of our people are living in poverty, which is far higher than any other industrialized country. And even sadder is the fact that almost 22% of our children live in poverty. Now, might the Republican leadership want to address the problem of growing poverty in America? Not really. They have an enormously important issue out there, and that is the Pledge Protection Act. Now, people probably are not going to believe me, but there was a major debate about the need to prohibit federal courts, Supreme Court and other federal courts, from hearing cases involving the Pledge of Allegiance. Poverty in America is growing. The middle class is shrinking. Gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider, and we were there, fiercely debating the Pledge Protection Act. Furthermore, while our health care system continues to disintegrate and while we lose millions of good-paying jobs, the Republican leadership was there encouraging people to sustain the president's veto on the stem cell research bill, which the president has decided is murdering human life, as best as I can understand what he is talking about. You have the entire scientific community, virtually the entire scientific community, saying that stem cell research is enormously important and opens up tremendous opportunities for breakthroughs in Alzheimer's, in diabetes, in spinal cord injury, in many other injuries. And yet the president has decided to veto that legislation, which will give our scientists the opportunity to make significant breakthroughs in a number of major illnesses and diseases in America. So what you see in Washington this week is not just reactionary legislation, but a very clear attempt to deflect the attention of the American people away from the real issues that impact their lives, real debate, real solutions, as how we can improve the standard of living for the American people, about how we can provide health care to all people. There was another hearing on global warming, and we still have an administration that, while giving lip service to trying to do something about carbon dioxide emissions, really still is not on board in acknowledging what virtually the entire scientific community acknowledges, is that global warming is man-made, that it is a huge crisis, that we've got to address it immediately. They're not quite there yet. They're still talking about, you know, different points of view and so forth and so on. So the message of this week is not just that we have an extreme right-wing president, but you have people who use the political process to deflect attention away from reality, try to create new realities to engage their right-wing base, while at the same time they continue to pander to the big money interests that fund their party. Now, one issue which was in the real world, and unfortunately they were on the wrong side of it, was another trade agreement. This is called the Oman trade agreement, which continues along the other disastrous trade agreements that have been passed by Congress and strongly supported by the Republican leadership and the Bush administration. This is an agreement with Oman, a country which does not have a minimum wage, a country which is not a democracy, and would, if passed, and it certainly it was passed in the House and it will be passed and signed by the president, continues the process by making it easier for large multinational corporations to throw American workers out on the street, outsource our jobs to countries which pay people pennies an hour. And that was also passed just the other day in Congress.
Bernie, the Oman trade agreement, which passed yesterday, the day before, in the House of Representatives, it had previously passed in the Senate. It didn't get quite all the hysterical media coverage of the Dubai deal because they weren't trying to buy one of our ports, but now they can.
Yeah.
That bill would not have been able to pass if Democrats hadn't, a number of Democrats, I think it was 22 as I recall, had crossed over and voted with the Republicans.
No,
because
no,
there were Republican defectors from this thing.
Yes, there were.
You know, one of them was Brian Baird, who's a guy who's a regular on my local program, and I haven't talked with him about it yet, but I talked with his office, and they were like, well, you know, Boeing is in our district, and they're a major exporter to Oman, and so they're, you know, there are some members of Congress, I think, who thought that they were voting in the best interests of their constituents or their donors. I'm not sure, but you know, what's your take on the Democrats who crossed over?
Well, back it up a little bit and understand that Bill Clinton was one of the
he's the guy who started it all. Yeah,
I mean, you know, Bill Clinton was in fact the irony here, and many people believe this, and I do as well. That if Clinton had not been in the White House, if it was a Republican, NAFTA would not have been passed, because Clinton had to exert enormous pressure on fellow Democrats to get them to support NAFTA, which certainly a Republican president would not have been able to do. And from NAFTA, we went on to permanent normal trade relations with China. So you can argue that while it is very clear that the Republicans in Congress are far more supportive of these terrible trade agreements, there is also Democratic support, and we had Clinton pushing that when he was president. So to some degree, this is a bipartisan effort, but I believe that when we talk about the decline of the middle class in America today and the increase in poverty, one of the key reasons is our disastrous trade policy, which has led to the loss of almost 3 million good-paying manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years, many of them attributable to outsourcing. And what many studies indicate that we're on the cusp now of losing a lot of white-collar information technology jobs to India, to China, and other countries. This is a huge, huge, huge issue, which is not simply solved, but certainly needs vigorous debate on the floor of the House. And what we get is the same old, same old. I mean, it is this, as you know, Tom, there's a definition of insanity that if you keep doing the same thing, you should expect the same results. Well, they keep passing these terrible trade agreements, and lo and behold, isn't it amazing? The trade deficit continues to go up, and we continue to lose good-paying jobs. What a shock.
Yeah, what a shock, indeed. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie.org, his website. I'm going to drop into our live chat room, TomHartmann.com. Our telephone number, the lines are filling up. Toll free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls for Bernie Sanders right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, Bernie.org. You want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Just click live chat up at the top of the page. Our telephone number, toll free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Mr. Congressman Sanders and Tom. Congressman Sanders, it may not be reality, but would you ever consider introducing a bill when you're hopefully elected senator that would tie the cost of living to the minimum wage, and we can stop this nonsense of the cheap Republicans holding their, you know, holding this up for years and years and years and years? Would you consider that idea?
You mean a COLA that just, the minimum wage goes up automatically as inflation goes up?
Just like the good people that are on Social Security have been getting for since 1970.
Gary, I mean, this is not a radical idea or a new idea. That is certainly something that we should be doing. Obviously, the debate is of what the base should be. But as you probably know, Gary, the minimum wage today, the national minimum wage at $5.15 an hour, is at its lowest purchasing power, I believe, in 50 years. And the fact, the idea, that the Republican leadership continues to give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1% and do not have the decency, the morality, if you like, to raise the minimum wage is beyond comprehension. So the answer to your question is absolutely, I don't have to introduce it, believe me, many people have, and it is something that we certainly should be doing.
And it's going to take a change in Congress to make it happen.
Absolutely. I mean, it is just incredible. And, you know, what gets me a little bit going, Tom, is these guys talk about moral values, right? You've heard it once or twice. They're the party of morality, and they can't raise the minimum wage for millions of American workers. Now, the good news on that issue is that many, many states, including my own state of Vermont, have said, we're not going to wait for the federal government. We're going to do it. But that our national government cannot raise the minimum wage is just disgraceful.
Well said. Bob in Dearborn, Michigan, on the line with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Congressman.
Hi.
Tom, I know that you're aware that Dearborn's the highest concentration or Arab population outside of the Middle East in the United States.
Yep. Used to live near there.
Right. I was wondering if Bernie had a thought on this. Is the administration or Congress at all aware that there's starting to become a perception, at least I know there is here in Dearborn, that it's okay that Arab people are getting killed by record numbers daily?
Well, Bob, you raise an issue that we could talk about for a very, very long time, and that is the horror that's taking place in the Middle East.
But, I mean, the protests here, I mean, it's daily. I mean, for the past, you know, 10 to 12 days since all this stuff has been going on in Beirut,
yeah.
I mean, it's just, I mean, roads are just lined up.
Is there like a xenophobia against Arabs developing there, a backlash against Arabs?
No, I wouldn't say that. It's just, you know, I mean, I've talked to just even neighbors of mine, but it's just getting to the point where, you know, it just seems like our government, I mean, nobody's talking to anybody over there, or at least it's not being reported. And it just reeks of authoritarianism where, you know, they have all this power and they think that, you know,
they're playing the tough guy role.
But
let me just say this. I mean, I think what we have is a horror. It is a nightmare, and every day the situation is getting worse. And it's getting worse not only through the bloodshed that is taking place in the Mideast right now, but we are laying the groundwork, I think, for future horrors to come. I'm not going to sit here and say that George Bush is the cause of all this. I mean, you know, this business has been going on for 50 years now. But one of the things, clearly, if we recognize that the United States is the most powerful nation on earth, that our job is to understand that the Middle East is today and has been for so many years a tinderbox, and what happens there impacts the whole world. I mean, common sense would suggest that our president, our administration would be leading the world, along with the United Nations, along with other European Union, etc., in trying, I mean, not just today, but months ago, years ago, trying to do what we can to further the peace process. And I think, you know, in all fairness to Bill Clinton, he made that effort very, very difficult. He did make that effort with some success. But where we are right now is a situation where the entire world, especially Muslims throughout the Middle East, look at the United States with great suspicion now because of our role in Iraq. And I don't have to tell you, Tom, I mean, what's going on in Iraq today is beyond belief. It's a country just disintegrating.
Yeah, Harry Reid has now said we're in a civil war. We should acknowledge it.
I mean, it is just a horror. People, innocent people getting mowed down. But to answer Bob's question, I mean, clearly what we have needed and have not gotten from this administration, admittedly it is very difficult, is to play the role of the even-handed broker trying to bring people together. What you got right now is you got Hamas, you got Hezbollah who want to destroy Israel, you got Israel now bombing like mad in Lebanon, you're making a horrible situation worse, and we're going to need the world community to act, and act vigorously and quickly.
Well said. 27 minutes past the hour. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, our number 866-440-8466, and we'll be right back after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Life's like a road that you travel on. There's one day here and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside every darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. Where the brave are free and lovers soar, come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate to break down the garden gate. There's not much time left today.
And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active on that highway of life, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our number 866-440-8466. And Steve in Amherst, Massachusetts, you are live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I applaud your voices of reason. I wanted to focus on the Republican leadership and how in the next election, it's so easy to criticize Bush. His approval rating is low. He's an easy target. But I think we have to hold the Republican Party responsible for actions or lack of actions. So and focus voter anger where it's appropriate. For example, Bush appointed Bolton, UN ambassador, as a recess appointment. It probably wouldn't have passed the Senate. At least that's what the news reports were. So he did it during a recess. Why is this not made news? Why are the Democrats not making this an issue? And could the Republicans, if they chose, could they bring this up at this point for reconsideration?
Well, Bernie, wasn't it a Republican who was threatening, who was blocking the Bolton appointment,
yes,
and he just recently
right.
recanted?
Turned around on that issue.
Was it Inhofe or Sensenbrenner or one of those guys?
I don't
remember who it was.
Neither do I.
Yeah.
Let me just touch on a few of the points that Steve makes. You know, mm-hmm. Tom, one of the things, Steve is absolutely right, is that, you know, Bush is an easy target. In my view, the evidence is overwhelming that he is the worst president in my lifetime, and certainly will go down in history. I think he's one of the worst presidents in American history. But be that as it may, he's not the only player in Washington. And if we are serious about reversing the impact of Bush's policy, you've got to look at the Republican Party as a whole, and we have to understand that the Republicans control the House of Representatives, they control the U.S. Senate, and now they control the Supreme Court as well. And if people really want to change what goes on in America, it's not just good enough to be attacking George Bush. One has got to be involved in the political process. There is an election coming up in November. And right now, you know, everyone is saying, oh, my goodness, you know, the Republicans can't win. Don't believe that at all. It is absolutely possible that at the end of the day, the Republicans could still retain control of both the House and the Senate. And I just want to caution those people who are not sympathetic to the Bush administration or right-wing Republicanism that we've got to work very, very hard. On the other hand, there is a chance that if the cookies, you know, crumble in the right way, the Democrats could take control over the House and the Senate, or maybe one of those bodies. But nothing is a done deal, and I hope that people are not overly confident and think, oh, my goodness, Republicans are certainly going to lose. That is not the case. A lot of work is going to have to be done. But when Steve talks about Republican control, what every listener should know is the way Congress works is that every single committee in the U.S. House of Representatives and in the U.S. Senate is controlled by Republicans. If you are concerned about global warming, understand that the chairman of the Environmental Committee in the U.S. Senate believes that global warming is a quote-unquote hoax. If you're concerned about giving more tax breaks to the wealthy or the privatization of Social Security, Bill Thomas, who is the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the House, is working feverishly to do just those things. And people sometimes say, well, why don't the Democrats bring this thing up? Why don't they bring it up on the floor of the House? It doesn't work that way, at least in the House. In the vast majority of the cases, in order to get a bill on the floor of the House, it has to go right through the Republican leadership. So the reason that we spend hours debating the Pledge Protection Act rather than health care for all is that they determine what gets to the floor of the House. In terms of Bolton, the Republicans could do anything they wanted to do. They could bring up any measure they want. When they want to bring up a measure, they can and do snap their fingers and it's on the floor of the House in a few minutes if they want to do that. So they can do whatever they want to do. But again, I would just reiterate Steve's point. Control over the House and the Senate is enormously important. If you are concerned about getting questions asked and answered about why we got into Iraq in the first place, those questions, those hearings, those investigations will never take place so long as the Republicans control the House and the Senate. So there's a lot of work to be done in the next 4 months.
Time out. Time to get out there and get active.
It really is.
Start going door to door.
And I want to say this. I don't want to inject my own campaign into this, but, you know, as many listeners know, I'm running for the Senate in Vermont. And one of the things that we are doing is our goal is to literally have people knock on half of the doors in the state of Vermont. And I think that that is an idea that people should be utilizing all over America. Go out. Knock on doors. Talk to people. And you will be surprised that people really want to be involved in the political process. They want to hear what you have to say. They want to contribute their ideas.
Well said. Jared in South Bend, Indiana. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Love your show. Congressman Sanders, I'd like to applaud you for speaking directly to the American people on a regular basis. I wish more legislators did it. My question is also about the nightmare that's going on in the Middle East right now. For a long time, I've been very, very frustrated with the United Nations and its seeming inability to act decisively on anything. Before Bush got us into a ridiculous and unnecessary war in Iraq, I don't remember how many resolutions passed before some kind of action, ill-advised as it was, took place. But, you know, the UN resolved over and over again to do something, and it never did. So my question is, do you think it's politically feasible both from a standpoint of the image that, that the United States has abroad and from a standpoint of how much action the United Nations is actually capable of taking for the United States to take a leadership role in trying to get this conflict resolved, either with some kind of peacekeeping force or some other kind of diplomatic mission, because right now nothing seems to be working.
Bernie, if I can toss something in here real quick.
Yeah.
I have United Nations Security Council Resolution 1559 in front of me. It was passed in 2004 to end the Syrian occupation. And basically, the UN said, okay, if Syria leaves, then the rest of the world has to step in so that Hezbollah, so that this kind of cancer that is there right now doesn't happen. And reading from the resolution, quote, this resolution calls for the disbanding and disarmament of all Lebanese and non-Lebanese militias, supports the extension of control of the government of Lebanon over all Lebanese territory, and calls upon all parties concerned to cooperate fully and urgently with the Security Council for the full implementation of this. And to the best of my knowledge, the U.S. didn't say to Lebanon, hey, you're a democracy, you're an ally of ours, we're going to help you, you know, help you pull together South Lebanon.
I would agree with that interpretation, Tom. The call asks what role we can play. We are the most powerful nation on earth, and as I mentioned earlier, there is an enormous responsibility on our shoulders to play a positive role within the United Nations and with the rest of the world community. So to answer the question, I think we should be demanding that the UN and the European Union and Russia and the entire world community begin to move to try to not only stop the killing that is taking place today, but deal with the more deep-seated issues. We have, among other things, what really upsets me here is you have the spiraling of violence. You got Hezbollah, who wants to destroy Israel. That's not acceptable. Israel has a right to exist. The same for Hamas. You have Israel now, wrecking Lebanon, which is terrible, and which is only going to cause more anti-Israeli feelings, and there's an enormous amount of work that the United States and the UN has got to do, and we've got to get moving on it.
Nick in Pueblo, Colorado, you're live with Bernie Sanders. Hey, Nick. Nick? Okay, we'll put Nick on hold, and we'll go to another caller here. Jeremy in Bloomington, Illinois. Hey, Jeremy, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
How you doing, guys? I'd like to thank you both for everything you guys do. What my concern is, and I have a couple questions really that I'll cut myself loose after I ask, and I'll just listen to the response on the radio. Will Amat Lieberman race? If Lamont wins, Lieberman said he's going to run as an independent. And what concerns me is it definitely will splinter some of the Democratic vote between the two, because it'll be a three-way race, and the chances of a Republican challenger winning that seat, increases tenfold if they're going to split that vote up. Is Lieberman essentially, do you guys think that he's just throwing a bone to the Republicans saying, here, take my seat, or does he really seriously want to keep his seat as an independent?
Well, I think the latest poll, and polls are worth whatever they're worth, they change every day, is Lamont is now ahead of Lieberman in the Democratic primary.
Yeah.
But also there are polls that show that if the election were held today and it were a three-way race, that Lieberman would win in a three-way race. Apparently the Republican candidate there is quite weak. So as of today, this could change tomorrow, it appears that Lieberman or Lamont, even in a three-way race, would be one of the victors.
So either way, the
Republicans would not get that seat. The Republicans, by the way, want to get rid of that weak candidate and try to find somebody else. But as of now, that candidate appears to be very weak.
Interesting. Okay. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie.org, his website. Please check it out. And also you can give us a call at 1-866-440-8466. And Bernie will be back answering your questions after this, right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, Transforming the World by Revitalizing Democracy in the United States of America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
We've been moving so fast. And welcome back to the radio support group brought by for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, Bernie.org, his website. And welcome back, Bernie. And our, let's see, 866-440-8466, our number, Martha in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Martha, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much. It's really great to hear the two of you projecting a voice of sanity into the world today. There's not much of it.
Thank you.
I have a nightmare recurring, and it looks like it's becoming a reality, and that is that ever since we broke Iraq, and we have broken it, it is threatening more and more every day to become a Shia majority with the help of Iran, who is doubtless sending people there to help with the civil war, to murder all the Sunnis. And as we have totally broken Iraq and really fed into destabilizing the Middle East, now the timing is such that Israel is now breaking Lebanon, which was, on that side of things, the only hope for sanity, for a Sunni majority, democratic, pro-America or pro-Western country. And my fear is that it's being broken so
badly. Is there a question in there, Martha, for Bernie? I'm sorry.
Yes, I do. I do. My fear is that it's being broken so badly that it will become a Shia majority also. My question is, what can we do to head that off, to stop that from happening?
Well, Martha, I just want to say that your assessment is a tragic one, but I think a realistic one. The U.S. role in Iraq has led to, you know, Tom, I mean, every time you open the paper, I mean, it is just, it's a country in the midst of disintegration where anyone who has any money in Iraq is trying to get us out of there as fast as they can. They're losing their middle class. Kids are afraid to go to school. You have electricity that's not working now, and people are sweltering in incredible heat. People now walking into shopping markets and just shooting people. I mean, it is
100 people a day dying now.
It is just unbelievable. It is a nightmare. I think it's the word Martha used. And now, you know, we got the war going on in Lebanon. All that I could say to Martha is, you know, and I say this without a great deal of confidence that the Bush administration is capable of doing this. I mean, clearly, what has to happen are two things. Number one, there has to be an end to the bloodshed as soon as possible. We just can't see rockets going all over the Middle East killing innocent people. And second of all, there has to be a real focus on long-term solutions. Israel has the right to exist. There should be a two-state solution to the Middle East. The Palestinians are entitled to their own state. The United States can provide economic support to those countries, cut back on military support, use economics as a carrot to encourage people to demilitarize. There is a lot that the United States, the UN, the European Union, and other entities can be doing. Whether this president has the capability of doing that remains to be seen.
Indeed. Bonnie in Burkittstown, Pennsylvania, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. I'm calling about the language surrounding the economy and how we have to take control of it. And I have a question, too. But, for example, we have a post-industrial nation, and we have protectionist trade policies that protect multinational corporations whose goal is to smash labor and environmental rights. So now that I've framed the debate, I have to ask, what is it that we do export besides war and occupation? And, by the way, the mind that the Republicans are generating with World War III, we need to embrace that and say we need an FDR president.
Well, it's interesting. I'm on the floor very often, and I'm on one committee or another, and it is very interesting. It just occurred the other day when we were talking about the Oman Free Trade Agreement, how Republicans get on the floor and say, what's the problem? The economy is doing really well. Look at the GDP growth. Look at this and look at that. And yet what they choose not to focus on and what they choose to rewrite is the reality facing ordinary people. We are exporting good paying jobs. We are, to use Bonnie's point, we're also exporting militarism around the world. But importantly, and this is where I am very critical, Tom, of the media. It's not that the corporate media is overtly very right-wing. Fox, of course, is. But what they do is not really focus on the reality facing the lives of ordinary Americans. I go to many, many town meetings. We have many town meetings in the state of Vermont. And when I go to town meetings, what I always say to people is, tell me, how is the middle class doing? You tell me. Don't tell me what I want to hear. Things going well, things not going well. And 90, 95, 98% of the people at these meetings say, no, we're hurting. You know, we're working long hours. We're losing good-paying jobs. We're worried about what kind of economy is going to be there for our kids. We can't afford college education. Cost of health care is soaring. We're worried about our pensions. We're worried about the future of Social Security. We're worried about the national debt. And you got a president and a Republican leadership going around saying, oh, man, economy is really doing great.
And we need to worry about gay marriage.
And we need to worry about, protecting
the flag, right. You know.
There you go.
Yeah. Pardon my interrupting you.
No, that's not wrong.
Yeah, a good rant. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org is website. And please check it out. Bernie, thanks so much for being with
good
us.
Good to be with you, Tom. See you next week.
Yep, indeed.
Bye-bye.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back with more news and your calls in the next hour, in the third hour of our program. Andy Stern, the president of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, the national president, will be with us, talking about the nation's health care system and SEIU's challenge to George W. Bush. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Ken in Port Townsend, Washington, sends a note. He says, while Bush has effectively vetoed, or officially vetoed, just one bill, he has effectively vetoed 130 bills. With that number of signing statements detailing 750 points where he asserts his right to ignore or disobey the very laws he's signed, I don't think this point is worth making on the air. The one veto was just a publicity stunt for his anti-abortion base, of course. I agree with you, Ken. Well said. In fact, one of the most succinctly and tightly well put together points on that. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. I'm going to drop into our live chat room. Just go to TomHartman.com, click live chat. We also have a message board at TomHartman.com where you can participate, and a blog, as it were, the archives of this and previous programs. I'd like to talk for a few minutes about the Republican Party, if I may. The Republican Party is the Republican Party in name only. Here we have, you know, for example, yesterday, George W. Bush speaking before the NAACP, which he referred to as the NAACP, which is a sort of like saying, I mean, it's just, it's like, that's not how you say it. Sorry. It's like somebody coming to speak before Bush and the Republican Party and saying, well, I'm so glad to be here speaking before you Republicans. You know, I mean, if you mangle or mispronounce or say, yeah, it wasn't cute. And the folks there got it, that it wasn't cute. In fact, a lot of them felt dissed by it. But in any case, one of the points that Bush made is he said, I understand that many African Americans distrust my political party. In fact, that was actually an applause line, the applause line of the speech. And then he went on to say, and this is where it gets interesting. He went on to say, I consider it a tragedy that the party of Abraham Lincoln, now remember that for a moment, that the party of Abraham Lincoln let go of its historical ties with the African-American community. I would submit to you that the Republican Party of today has no right to invoke the name of Abraham Lincoln, because it is no longer the party of Abraham Lincoln. it's, you know, in a more contemporary sense, you could say it's no longer the party of Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen and Dwight Eisenhower. But in the largest sense, it is definitely no longer the party of Abraham Lincoln. In 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, when the modern-day Republican Party was incorporated, was created, and Lincoln was their second candidate for president, their first serious candidate, the only one who won, the first one who won, the Republican Party was very, very different. Back, I don't know, a couple, 3, 4 years ago, Rob Call, a friend of mine, he runs opednews.com. Rob's a junkie for old books. Rob and I are both book collectors. And we were out traveling around and walked into an old used bookstore, And I found a pair, or Rob found them for me and gave them to me, actually, a pair of books published in the 1860s. That were the histories of the Republican Party and the history of the Democratic Party. The history of the Democratic Party, of course, went back to 1800, or really 1798, when Thomas Jefferson pulled together the Democrats and the Republicans and created the Democratic Republican Party, which is today known as the Democratic Party, the longest lasting political party in the history of the world. And then the history of the Republican Party started in 1856. Now, these two big leather-bound books that were published in the 1800s, and so they really only went through the mid-1870s, because it takes a while to write and typeset and print, or it did back in the 1860s, a book. And the last Republican Party platform that they had was in 1872. And I think this is so important, particularly for your Republican friends, for you to share with your Republican friends this information. Because the Republican Party was started in 1856 as a reform party. The Democratic Party at that point had become too closely associated with slavery and had become too corrupt. They had had too much power for too long, and the Republican Party was started as a reform party, as a progressive party in many ways. Abraham Lincoln was, you know, today, if Abraham Lincoln was around, he'd be called a progressive. So let me just share this with you. I wrote about this back in October of 2003 in an article called Republicans, Please Take Back Your Party. If you go to TomHartmann.com and click Articles on Democracy, you can find it. But it's pretty straightforward stuff. In Lincoln's time, for example, the idea of strikes was so novel that the word strike was put in quotation marks in newspapers. But Lincoln was often on their side. Labor, Lincoln said, is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor, and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior to capital and deserves much the higher consideration. Abraham Lincoln, the first president to support strikers and unions. Then you look at the Republican Party's campaign platform of 1872. This was before the Republican Party sold out to the big railroads in the 1880s and became the party of big business, which it's been ever since. But back when it was the party of Lincoln, even though Lincoln was dead, he'd been assassinated, 8 years earlier, whatever. 1872, the Republican Party's campaign platform. The Republicans of 1872 didn't think that anybody should be appointed to high office just because he was a party hack, or like Colin Powell's son being the head of the FCC, the son of the Secretary of State. Instead, they wrote in their platform, and this is a quote from the Republican Party platform of 1872, "Any system of civil service under which the subordinate positions of the government are considered rewards for mere party zeal is fatally demoralizing. And we, therefore, favor a reform of the system by laws which shall abolish the evils of patronage and make honesty, efficiency, and fidelity the essential qualifications for public positions." But now, every ambassador that Bush has appointed has been appointed because of the amount of campaign money that they've raised for the Bushies. Virtually all the senior officials in the Bush administration, virtually all of their political appointees, have to do with whether or not they're pioneers or rangers, how much money they raised. The Republican Party of 1872 didn't think that corporations, particularly big ones, should get the kind of freebies that corporations today regularly demand for moving into a community. You know, corporations play one community off another. Hey, you know, they'll give us a $10 million tax break. Will you give us a $20 million tax break? We'll put our factory here. Instead, resources owned by we, the people, should be held in trust for or given to human beings. As the Republican Party wrote in their platform of 1872, quote, "We are opposed to further grants of public land to corporations and demand that the national domain be set apart for free homes for the people." The Republicans of 1872 felt that the national debt from the Civil War, it was fairly substantial at that time, should be paid off as quickly as possible, and a budget should not only be balanced, but show a surplus while at the same time paying pensions to retired persons. They were also protectionists in favor of importing import duties and tariffs to protect working people's salaries and keep manufacturing jobs from moving offshore. This is how they said it in the Republican Party platform in the presidential election in 1872. Quote, "The nation's annual revenue, after paying current expenditures, pensions, and the interest on the national debt, should furnish a moderate balance for the reduction of the principal of the national debt, and that revenue should be raised by duties," this is tariffs, "upon importations, the details of which tariffs should be so adjusted as to aid in securing remunerative wages to labor." In other words, we're going to put up tariffs to protect domestic industry, to protect our local jobs, so that our textile industry doesn't go offshore, so that our, you know, and on and on. The details of these tariffs should be protected, should be adjusted so as to aid in securing remunerative wages to labor and promote the industry's prosperity and growth of the whole country. End quote. That's the Republican platform of 1872. The Republicans of 1872, having just freed the slaves, in part at least, this, keep in mind, this was before the separate but equal decision that came nearly 20 years later. Anyhow, also that was in 1898. Also spoke to that era's women's struggle for equal rights. Their platform explicitly said, and I quote, "The Republican Party is mindful of its obligations to the loyal women of America for their noble devotion to the cause of freedom. Their admission to wider fields of usefulness is viewed with satisfaction." Here's the Republican Party coming out for women's rights, and now the Republican Party will not even allow the Equal Rights Amendment to be ratified, to be passed. I mean, they've been blocking this thing for the better part of a decade. The Republicans back in 1872, "and the honest demand of any class of citizens for additional rights should be treated with respectful consideration," end of quote, from the Republican Party platform of 1872. It is time for the Republicans to either be called out and point out that they are no longer, this is no longer the Republican Party. It's got nothing to do with Republican values. It's got nothing to do with American values, today's Republican Party. You've got a bunch of corporatists and a bunch of guys who are, you know, pigs at the trough. Like Billy Towson, who, you know, pushed through the Medicare bill so that his friends in the big pharma industry could make millions while he's negotiating $1 million a year salary as their head lobbyist, which he is now. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Come on over, come on over, come on in, come inside, baby. Won't you come on up, come on in, oh, come inside, baby.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE, right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And we're talking about the Republican Party and its history. I just want a little bit more here to share with you, because this is really not just the history of the Republican Party. This is the history of American politics. And you get it when you go back and you look at how things, you know, how there's been this kind of amnesia recently about what politics in America used to be about. It used to be about real issues, and it used to be really, well, as the Republicans of 1872 had repealed most of Lincoln's wartime abrogations of civil rights. You'll recall Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, first president to do so. And opposed, the Republicans of 1872 opposed any other Patriot Act-like interferences with civil liberties. They were rediscovering the Bill of Rights, and they said so in Party Platform Plank 16. This is from the 1872 Republican Party platform. Quote, "The Republican Party Now, keep in mind, this is from today, these guys who call themselves Republicans want to take away our civil liberties in the name of protecting our civil liberties. If you can figure out how that makes any sense, you know, give me a call, let me know. But you were watching them do it, right? Okay, here's from the Republican Party platform of 1872. The Republican Party proposes to respect the rights reserved by the people to themselves as carefully as the powers delegated to them by the states and the federal government. It disapproves of the resort to unconstitutional laws for the purpose of removing evils. By interference with rights not surrendered by the people to either the state or national government. End of quote. You get that? I mean, this is yes, it's 19th century language, but it's pretty unambiguous. It's pretty clear. The Republican Party proposes to respect the rights reserved by the people to themselves, in other words, the Bill of Rights, as carefully as the powers delegated by them to the states and federal government. It disapproves of the resort to unconstitutional laws for the purpose of removing evils by interference with rights not surrendered by the people to either the state or national government. And now, here we have rights not surrendered by the people, but being taken by the Bush administration. You know, the right to a trial by jury, the right to face your accuser, the right to due process, the right to privacy. The Republican Party in 1872 said, no, we will not put this stuff away. We will not put this stuff up. And finally, the party platform said the Republicans would embrace only modest patriotism and incorruptible integrity in their leaders because the nation's honor was, in that day, kept in the highest respect throughout the world. The party noted that it had first achieved national power with Lincoln's election, quote, during 11 years of supremacy, it has accepted with grand courage the solemn duties of the time. Republicans had emancipated 4 million slaves, decreed the equal citizenship of all, and established universal suffrage, exhibiting unparalleled magnanimity. The Republican Party criminally punished no man for political offenses. And tax revenues have been carefully collected and honestly applied. And then here's the, you know, blissfully unaware of how corrupt their party would end up. Here's where the prescient end to the platform of 1872, the last sentence. We believe the people will not entrust the government to any party or combination of men composed chiefly of those who have resisted every step of such beneficent progress. And since then, what do we get? The Republican Party has been seized by, you know, everybody from the libertarians and the objectivists, the utopians, the Grover Norquists, the Jack Abramoffs. I mean, it has been destroyed. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's up in Washington, D.C. today?
The president is getting back from his trip, and he's going to be meeting with Condoleezza Rice. Apparently, they're going to be announcing a plan. They are also going to be meeting, apparently, with the Saudi ministers and Prince Bandar, who, of course, used to be the ambassador to the United States. And
Bandar Bush.
Also, I'm sorry?
Bandar Bush.
Yes, Bandar Bush, exactly. And that is their plan at this point to really make their imprint. She's going to be apparently going to the region on Tuesday. But, of course, as you and I talked earlier about, this is a plan to let the Israelis do their thing, and then she can come in and, you know, and now
so the Bush administration is figuring that, you know, when all is said and done, they'll look like the guys who rode in on the white horse, but they're going to wait a while.
Right. The other announcement is that Tony Blair is going to be coming next week, and he's going to be having his discussions with the White House. So it looks like foreign interest next week.
There you go. And he will be sure that all microphones around him are actually unplugged.
I am sure.
There you go.
Have a good one. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. was out there. Yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much.
No, it just means you know too much. Welcome back, my friends, to the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. You know, the reason why I wanted to share with you that backstory on the Republican Party, first of all, most people don't realize that up until the 1880s, the Republican Party was a reform party. Secondly, what it says is that in the 1880s, the Democratic Party began becoming the Reform Party, and they really, you know, the Teddy Roosevelt, the Bull Moose Party really pushed the Democrats even farther into the progressive mold after the turn of the century. And the Great Depression, of course, the Democrats saved America saved capitalism from itself. And the Democratic Party has been the party of the working people and of democracy ever since, in a large way, as it originally started out. The reason I share all this with you is because it's so important for us to understand that the traditions of America, regardless of party label, have been fundamentally small d democratic. They've been fundamentally egalitarian. They've been, you know, fundamentally rooted in the idea that a strong middle class, a large middle class, where people have the power, where we the people are the ones who are saying to government, this is what you should do. Where the traditional, the 7,000-year civilized history pyramid of kings or theocrats or warlords at the top, or the rich, in the case of feudalism, has been flipped upside down in terms of political power, and the people are at the top in terms of having political power. And the institutions, you know, they can exist, but they're under the control of the people. That's the history of this country. And we are losing it really rapidly. And we're losing it at the hands of people who call themselves Republicans, who have nothing to do with the values on which that party was founded. And yesterday, George Bush invoking Abraham Lincoln before the NAACP was, in my mind, an obscenity. Here's just another example of this. The right now we have employer-provided pensions in the United States. You know, a pension is different from a savings account. A pension is essentially an insurance policy for retirement. That is to say, you get a fixed amount of money for the rest of your life. If you die early, you don't get any more. If you die late, you get a whole lot more. That's what a pension is. It's like Social Security is a form of pension. Whereas a 401k is more like a savings account. Yeah, you spend it, you're when it's all gone, it's all gone. Sorry, Charlie, you're on the street. Well, most of our pensions are the result of a lot of many generations of hard work and a lot of bloodshed and a lot of hard work on the part of unions and organized labor across the United States. But the corporations in America that have been guaranteeing pensions, they've been saying to their laborers, to their workers, yeah, sure, if you'll build cars for us, if you'll build bridges for us, if you'll work for us, we'll set aside some money for a pension for you. They've been lying to us. Pensions in the United States are underfunded by $450 billion. $450 billion. That's $450,000 million. And the agency that insures them is underfunded by, or has a deficit actually right now from bailing out pension funds, at $22.8 billion. So now you've got airlines like Northwest and Delta. They want out. They want 20 years to stretch out their pension payments. American and Continental, they're not in bankruptcy. They're asking for pension relief. I mean, basically what the deal is here with this so-called pension relief is that the Republicans are saying, screw the working people. We wouldn't want the corporations to get into trouble financially, after all. So instead of the government bailing them out, which is why the Federal Pension Guarantee Corporation was created, instead of the government bailing out the pensions and then holding the companies criminally liable when they underfund their pensions, as they should be, instead the Republicans want to change the law. This bill will be voted on
in the House next week, the Senate soon after. This is a piece of legislation that House Majority Leader John Boehner is pushing through, the Republican from Ohio, Boehner, excuse me, that's basically going to give all these companies a pass and say, no, you don't have to pay the pensions of the workers. After all, they're just workers. They're just the producers. We could always find somebody from India to do their job, pack up the factory and move it to Mexico or China, no problem. So Bonner's pushing this piece of legislation to just put the nail in the coffin of the American middle class. And Congressman George Miller of California, good on you, George Miller, stands up and says no. And, in fact, calls the Republicans in the House of Representatives criminals for pushing this thing forward. Here's George Miller, Congressman, Democrat from California, on the floor of the House yesterday.
We were all stunned as a nation when pensioners got their plans wiped out and devastated by Enron. We called those people criminals. Here we call them legislators. Because people are going to get a devastating hit on their pensions. And we're going to say it's the law. There we said it was a crime. We said it was a crime. You have plenty of time on your side. You say it's a crime.
See what's going on. The Republicans keep trying to interrupt him, trying to shut him up. They don't want this stuff on the record. Hey, C-SPAN is watching. Hey, George Miller, shut up and sit down. And he's like, no, I'm not going to shut up and sit down. I'm not going to start stop speaking the truth.
But I haven't been called a criminal. What are you doing to people? You know, you control the conference, you control the White House, you control the House, you control the Senate, control your time. The fact of the matter is, this is the same thing. We're making a conscious decision to rip away these pension benefits from these workers. And the most devastating thing about this decision, it's not necessary. You can have massive pension reform to the benefit of the employees, to the benefit of the employers, to the benefit of the shareholders, without devastating the older workers. So why don't we do it right? Why don't we do it in a humane way? Why don't we do it right in recognizing the situation that America's older workers find themselves in? People 50, 55, 60 years old, what are they going to do? Take a second job for the retirement? Maybe their spouse can go out and take a third job for the retirement? That's not the way we should treat American citizens. That's not the way we should treat taxpayers. And that's not the way we should treat hardworking American families.
Well said. Congressman George Miller of California calling the Republicans criminals. The House Republicans, criminals. House Majority Leader John Boehner on, you know, pushing this thing, this piece of legislation through that's just basically going to screw American workers who have pensions. And what are you going to do with these folks when they retire if they don't have a pension? Well, you get them a greeter's job at Walmart, don't you know, George? It's the Republican way. After all, the economy's going great, isn't it? I mean, I got my dividend check. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Richard in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't know if you've had an opportunity to watch it. Have you seen Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow and Joe McCarthy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, months ago when it came out, yeah.
It's an excellent movie. I just watched it on DVD a week ago. I was highly dismayed that they didn't make any sort of point about the fact that Joe McCarthy was a Democrat.
Joe McCarthy was a Republican.
I don't think so.
No, I'm quite sure of it. He was
really?
A Republican, yes. He was the Republican senator from Wisconsin.
Even more so that he got lambasted by another fellow Republican. Do you ever heard of Margaret Chase Smith?
The Democratic McCarthy that you're thinking of is Eugene McCarthy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
A whole different animal.
Whole nother animal.
Yeah.
But
Margaret Chase Smith was a Republican as well, as I recall.
That's right. And she got up on the Senate floor and gave a wonderful speech called the Declaration of Conscience.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you'd allow
she
me
the,
to...
She was the senator from... Moment. She was the senator from Connecticut or New York or...
Let me see here.
Was somewhere up there in the Northeast. Anyhow, you said
she gave this speech, and McCarthy, I guess, just sat there totally humbled by it.
Yeah, if it's not more than a sentence or two, Richard, you can share it, but by and large, we just have this rule of, you know,
people reading things on the air, I know. But she said this thing about the principles of Americanism, the right to criticize, the right to hold unpopular beliefs, the right to protest, and the right of independent thought.
Now, these are all the rights that the Bushies want to take away from us.
Exactly.
And they're aggressively doing it.
I mean, and here is a Republican woman who, I mean, in an era, this was delivered in 1950, in an era when women were pretty timid.
Well, Margaret Chase Smith was a relatively progressive Republican. I mean, that was back in the days when Republicans were not as badly corrupted as they are today, and she was considered a stateswoman.
Well, I think the real point you've made here is an important one, that it's not a matter of party. It's a matter of principle and the character of the individual.
Yes,
indeed. It's not, you know, parties come and go. Platforms come and go, they change, they vacillate, but the individuals who stand there in positions of power at any given time, they're the ones who make the call. They're the ones who push it forward, and that this is, you know, we're reliving it today. I watched that movie, and I was just stunned. We're doing it again today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Richard, thank you for the call, and thank you for sharing that. And, in fact, we're seeing it, this such corrupt behavior has become institutionalized in the Republican Party now. There are maybe three or four Republican members of Congress, a handful, who are acting with any kind of integrity anymore. The rest of them have frankly been gotten rid of. And then you've got the DLC Democrats. I mean, we've got some fellow travelers among the Democratic Party that eventually we need to weed out. And progressives need to. And hopefully that'll happen. But you're absolutely right, Richard. It's about the character of the people and the agenda, the program that they're advancing. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
As a young man, I found politics into Bush's arm I dove. And I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me. Cause when your administration's gone, the right will kiss my knee.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Residents of trailer parks set up by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, this out of Morgan City, Louisiana, by the Associated Press. These are the residents of trailer parks set up by FEMA to house hurricane victims in Louisiana. According to the Baton Rouge newspaper, it's called the Baton Rouge Advocate, are not allowed to speak to the press without an official escort. Say what? Americans are not allowed to speak to the press without an official escort? We're not talking about people who are convicted of felonies and serving time in federal prison. We're talking about people who committed the crime of being poor in time of a disaster. Not something that the Bush administration has much compassion for. I mean, this is incredible. In one instance, a security guard ordered a reporter out of a trailer during an interview in Morgan City. What happened to the First Amendment? What happened to our rights of free speech? Well, you know, the Bush administration that was kind of quaint. That's just a quaint old idea. We can't have that. And after all, I mean, these people are poor. I mean, this is all working out quite well for them anyway, isn't it? They don't have to speak out.
And so many of the people in the arenas here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. This is working very well for them.
This is working very well for them. They were underprivileged anyway, don't you know? Just ask Barbara Bush. Well, now they're living in FEMA trailers. A couple of questions that were being raised by the advocate, the Baton Rouge, Louisiana Advocate, the newspaper. They were curious why so many of the trailers were empty. Why people all over the United States who have fled Louisiana, whose houses are ruined, who think they have nothing to come back to, there's no place to go, don't know that there are a couple of hundred empty trailers sitting there in this trailer park. Well, they didn't quite want that story to get out. This is in Morgan City, the 334 trailer FEMA park in Devant in Plaquemines, I don't know how to pronounce it, Parish, is greatly underused. The north side of the park is empty. 92 families live on the south side, and 183 trailers are vacant. FEMA officials refuse to say how much was spent to build the park or why 183 of the trailers are vacant. Before the newspaper was able to silence one of the people there, they said, we all wonder why no one lives there, over in the empty half of the trailer park. In Morgan City, there's another trailer park. FEMA spent $7.5 million, gave it to private corporations affiliated with the Bushies, no doubt, to build a trailer park, 198 trailers. Only 15 of them are occupied. How come nobody's here? Hey, you can't talk to the press! Meanwhile, Plaquemines Parish President Benny Rossell blamed FEMA in part for the slow return of residents to the parish. Rossell said FEMA officials know where many evacuees located after the storm, relocated after the storm, but won't give that information to parish officials. Says Rossell, FEMA told us because of privacy issues. They can't give us the addresses of our residents who are spread out in all 50 states, and no one but FEMA has that information. If we contact them, I think a lot of them would come back if they knew that we had a place for them to live. But FEMA says to a reporter, nope, you got to get out of here. You cannot talk with these people. As FEMA spokesman Rachel Rohde said, quote, if a resident invites the media to the trailer, they have to be escorted by a FEMA representative who sits in on the interview. That's just a policy. Greg Leslie, legal defense director for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, said FEMA's refusal to allow trailer park residents to invite news media into their homes unescorted was just plain old flat out unconstitutional. Morgan City Mayor Timothy Matt told the local newspaper, the Baton Rouge Advocate, that he was surprised residents were being barred from talking to reporters. He says, I would think anyone who lives there would be allowed to have any visitor they wanted. No, sorry, Mayor Matt. You don't realize this is the Bush administration, FEMA. The Bush administration decides who can talk to whom. The Bush administration decides whether or not the press is traitorous and treasonous. The Bush administration decides whether or not they're going to listen in on your phone calls. And George W. Bush himself, after committing the crime of illegally wiretapping us in violation of the FISA law, decides that he's not going to allow his own Justice Department to investigate him. A felony, the cover-up, to stop prosecution or investigation of a felony breaking the FISA law. And then these guys run around and go, oh, no, this is the terrorist, anti-terrorist protection program or whatever they call this thing. Terrorist eavesdropping, terrorist surveillance program. That's what Gonzalez is calling this thing. It's called breaking the law. FEMA leases these parks, the land for the trailer park from the city. So the mayor says, hey, this is public property. There's no question about that. You'd think people would have the same freedom there as everyone else has. Nope, sorry. Not under the Bush administration. You can't talk to the press unless there's a member of the administration sitting right next to you. This is bizarre. This is not American. This is happening in America. It's not American. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where we run rings around the right wing. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, 365, well... 52 weeks out of the year. 913 days, 10 hours, 53 minutes, 11 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. The end of his term, that is, barring impeachment. We'll see. Days are counting down. Andy Stern is with us. He's the president of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. And Andy Stern, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom.
The international president of the SEIU. Andy, you, or President Stern, you are...
It's Andy.
Okay. You are challenging America's CEOs to help build a better healthcare system. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is, Tom, I think we all agree that we have a great country, and we also appreciate that we're going through very profound changes about work and globalization, competition. And we have a healthcare system I wrote in the Wall Street Journal editorial the other day that's really a horse and buggy system, a system built for the industrial era that's based on employers. And in a global economy, we just can't put the price of American goods, put the price of healthcare on the products. And so I said to the CEOs, let's work together to build a new American healthcare system that doesn't put the burden on you, that's based upon preventive care and everyone paying, and make sure that we use the best evidence available. But it's time for a new American 21st century healthcare system, and I think it's time for business to take the lead.
I think there was a bit of a wake-up call, what was it, a year and a half ago or so, when one of the Japanese auto manufacturers, my recollection is it was Toyota, it might have been Honda, was going to site a factory in North America. They were shopping around. Alabama thought they had it. They had offered them a couple $100 million in tax breaks and all these kind of things. And at the last minute, the auto manufacturer said, we're going to go to Canada because of the healthcare costs.
Well, you know, if you're a businessman and it's about the bottom line, think about it. If you're going to put $1,500 of healthcare on the cost of a car in Alabama, you can go across in Canada and save that $1,500. You know, it actually is good business sense. America is not going to compete in a global economy with a healthcare system that makes our employers uncompetitive. And what's kind of scary to me, Tom, is where are the employers? They should be the ones leading the parade that say it's time to build a new American system. Just like President Bush and Nancy Pelosi and Senator Frist, they all have, you know, a healthcare system that people get choices of doctors and plans, and we get the advantages of the private sector as well, and yet they're sitting around making America less competitive. We need good jobs, and we need to do something about our healthcare system.
Andy Stern, International President of SEIU, SEIU.org, of course, the website. Are you finding any corporate CEOs, any of these major power brokers in America, basically, in our increasingly neo-feudal state, who are going along with you on this?
Well, I mean, here's the good news. I've now been to a number of forums, and I've gotten a number of responses to my editorial, and I actually wrote all 500 Fortune 500 CEOs a letter on Tuesday as well. And the good news is there is an audience out there. I think the real question is will they have the courage, you know, to make the kind of demands on Congress? Washington is doing nothing about the health care crisis. Our politicians don't understand what most Americans are dealing with. They're one illness away from economic ruin. America's competitiveness is at stake, and the senators and congressmen in Washington, they have good health care and don't seem to really want to do anything. It's time for business to put light a fire under our elected officials.
Yeah, I mean, it even goes a step beyond that. The bankruptcy bill, for example, is so-called bankruptcy reform, making it more difficult and more painful and more brutal, the whole process of bankruptcy. And yet half of all bankruptcies in America are among employed people who have a medical crisis.
Absolutely.
Half of all bankruptcies.
Yeah, 40% of Americans in the next 2 years will be involved in some kind of collection effort with a company around health care bills.
Which brings us back to the problem that seems to be the problem behind the problem, the elephant in the room that nobody's talking about, and that is that we have a healthcare, we euphemistically call it a healthcare system, it's really a sickness system, that is incredibly profitable, and that the more it deals with sickness rather than prevention, the more money it makes.
And we also made another mistake, which even starts from the wrong premise. You know, in education, we assume everyone's entitled to a basic education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then different school districts can afford, you know, different bells and whistles, depending on how much taxes people want to pay.
Right.
But in healthcare, we didn't say, look, everyone has a basic system, and part of it is exactly what you said. It's about prevention. Everyone, we want to get the shots and the treatment and the care that they need before they get sick. And so now what we do is we treat people in the most expensive moment of their life when they show up in an emergency room rather than trying to take care of it by giving everyone some kind of basic health care benefit.
But we have in the United States, we pay about twice as much per capita, more, about almost twice as much compared to any other country in the world. And the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and yet it isn't producing the best outcome, as I'm sure you know.
Right.
And a lot of that is because you've got companies. I mean, here the second largest healthcare company, the health insurance company in the United States, just last year, as the Wall Street Journal outed in the front page of the front page article last month, paid their CEO $1.5 billion.
Right. There's a lot of money not going to take care of patients in the
healthcare
system.
So how do you go up against that? I mean, that's an industry that just, you know, chewed up Bill and Hillary Clinton and spit them out in the early 90s.
Well, that's why I think we need our CEOs to step forward. I mean, we have people that have conquered the internet, that have, you know, mapped the genome, that have conquered the world finances, that, you know, travel the world with all kinds of innovation. They can figure out this healthcare system and tell the private insurers and others that they want an effective and efficient system. But they need the courage to step forward. We're not going to do it in America because it's right. We will do it when it's about our economic competitiveness, and it's only the CEOs who can make that argument, and certainly not the ones who are taking in all that money or in Denver, Colorado, at seminars being put on by the drug industry.
Right. So ultimately, it's going to end up the CEOs of the manufacturing and service companies in the United States who are paying health care expenses versus the CEOs of the insurance companies and the big pharmaceutical companies.
Right. I appreciate they're all friends, but this is about America. It's about people's health. It's much bigger, you know, than can someone make a little bit more money. I mean, we're talking about people who go home every day and do worry about that one illness, or, as you said, are going bankrupt, or are worried about what they're going to do with their mother or grandmother as they get older. I mean, we're talking about something very fundamental that the American community has to solve, and Team USA needs a plan, and it can't be about money.
Andy Stern, International President of the SEIU, what can people do to get involved in what you're doing?
Well, first of all, I think they can demand both from their employers, if they're involved with them, and their friends, that American business step forward and say this employer-based healthcare system's over. We're ready to move to something new and different. They can demand from their elected officials that when they run from office, they ask them, what is your healthcare plan and how are you going to pay for it? Because in the end, we saw what happened when Congress tried to fix the prescription drug benefit. They created communist medicine. You can't even use the free market to bargain.
Well,
you know,
and Billy,
we're the drug company.
And Billy Townsend, at the same time that he was cutting that deal to make sure that the government couldn't negotiate with the drug companies, he was negotiating $1 million-a-year salary with pharma, which is where he's working now as a lobbyist.
I mean
this is a badly broken system.
We're not going to let the market work on matters as important as this. But more importantly, every other country in the world has figured this out. This is the greatest country on earth. We can figure out this healthcare problem as well.
Yeah, and is SEIU advancing a particular program, a single-payer health care system, for example, or Medicare for all, or are you simply saying, let's do something?
You know, we say that basically, you know, we want a system that everyone's covered. We want people to have choice of doctors. We want to have preventative care included. We want to have electronic medical records. We want people to have the information on the outcomes of their doctors and hospitals in terms of, are they helping people or hurting them? You know, you can construct from those principles a number of systems, including the ones you mentioned, or you could take the federal employee benefit health plan that every member of Congress and federal workers have. I mean, there are lots of choices here. What we don't have is a lot of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and SEIU is providing that. We just have 1 minute left here, Andy Stern. For those people who are not members of a union, is there some way that they can participate with SEIU in standing up like this beyond simply, you know, talking to friends and neighbors?
Sure. You can go on to SEIU.org. We have a group called Americans for Healthcare, SEIU.org, and you look for Americans for Healthcare, and they are people who are not union members. They're citizens and voters and people who have a profound interest in changing our healthcare system, and they're working in their own states to try to build that kind of grassroots change. And so SEIU.org, Americans for Healthcare.
Americans for Healthcare. Is that an organization which is derived from SEIU or with whom you're working?
We're partners with it, you know, works on its own, and it works with lots of groups in lots of different states who are all working for the same thing, a healthcare system that makes America great.
Yeah, this is just a foundational thing. It's just the foundation of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You have to be healthy to do it.
Absolutely.
Andy Stern, the international president of SEIU, SEIU.org, the website. Andy Stern, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Tom.
It's marvelous what you're doing. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
But it's just another day. It's just another day. When the girls on the street were all right with me. Just another day.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. And our listener line, by the way, if you don't want to call and be on the air, our to be on the air number, 1-866-440-8466, toll free all across the United States. If you have questions, comments, concerns, criticisms, compliments, whatever, 866-440-8466. But if you're a little shy and you'd like to just leave a message, we have a comment line. It's area code 503-323-6620. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less. So make it count, 503-323-6620. Here's a clip from our opinion line that came in this morning.
A lot of people who are calling Air America seem to be right-wing plants. They just want to call and interrupt the program and to give us the idea that, you know, there's more opposition out there, too, the Democrats, than there really is.
Good one. And I think you're right. In fact, we know that the Republicans during the last election were running boiler room operations where they were calling talk shows. If you go to the RNC website, if you sign up as a friend of the GOP or whatever, you don't even have to give them any money. You can just sign up. You get into their secret website at GOP.org or com or whatever it is. It's easy to find. They're the official Republican website. And there is a page in there where they list all the talk shows all across the United States and the phone numbers that you can call. So, you know, part of it is that you get this whole thing of you know, the grassroots caller. But the larger part of it, and this is a part that has been outed in the media, it has been in the news, is that there are Republican operatives who do nothing but call talk shows. And, in fact, yesterday, I'm driving down the street, and I was listening to 620 KPOJ, Portland's progressive talk station, which is where I live, and, you know, the station that I do a morning show for, and that carries this show on the weekends. And I heard a caller into another talk show, and it was just so clear to me. I mean, this guy starts out, and usually they start out one of two ways. This guy starts out going, I'm a Republican, and but I think you make a good point here, and let me tell you why. And then he goes into, you know, dropping the Republican memes. Well, you know, George Bush is doing what he's doing because he really believes in his principles. Nonsense. I mean, back in the 70s, George Bush was pro-choice. So was his father. Come on, give me a break. And he's pandering to his... But the guy is, like, dropping the memes. Or more often, frankly, when the Republican, what Limbaugh refers to as programmed callers... They're real. They're out there. When they call, they'll say, you know, I'm a Democrat and I'm on your side and you're doing a great job, and then blah, 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 and then out come the right wing talking points. And I just want to say I love it when those people call this program because I turn them into hamburger. But there's a lot of talk show hosts who can't, and you just, so as a listener, you have to learn how to discriminate and catch that, because I'm telling you, it is going on. This is the party that jammed the phone banks in New Hampshire, was convicted of that crime, and in all probability, now the trial date has been moved back after the election, but in all probability, what's going to come out in the lawsuits and trials around this thing is that it came from either Karl Rove or George Bush himself. to jam the phone banks in New Hampshire in the 2004 election, excuse me, the 2002 election, I guess it was, so that John Sununu would become senator rather than Gene Shaheen. Gene Shaheen was the very popular Democratic governor of New Hampshire. And she was running against the son of a former senator, the Republican son of a former senator who was a right-wing crank. And he was going to lose. And the Republicans jammed the get-out-the-vote phone banks, the Democratic Party, and unions working with the Democratic Party, and suppressed the Democratic vote. And John Sununu got in by a whisker. And whenever you hear his name, I mean, he's just another one. It's like, you know, it's just another one of these Republicans who got in by nefarious means, by crimes, by virtue of crimes. And this isn't just, you know, me ranting. I mean, this is a matter of public record. And so I think that it's time for us to start asking ourselves, you know, is this the kind of government we want? And start answering no. And so how do you solve the problem? It's very simple. You and I start getting involved. Let your members of Congress know your thoughts on issues. So start, you know, guiding and moving them and become a lobbyist. Get involved with the local political activity, whether that means showing up for the Green Party meetings or whether it means showing up for the Democratic Party meetings or even showing up for the Republican Party meetings and say, hey, you know, I've got a copy of the Republican Party plank from 1872. I think we ought to go back to some of these values. Republican Party, by the way, started in 1854. I said 1856. My bad. Thank you to the caller who straightened this out. But whatever, you know, get involved with electoral politics. Show up for Democracy for America. Go to democracyforamerica.com. Show up for one of the meetups. You know, show up at the drinking liberally things that are happening all over the country on Wednesday and Thursday, you know, whatever the night it may be around you. Again, here in Portland, it's on Wednesday nights. You know, start participating. That is the essence of democracy. Demos, it means the people, right? It's we the people. When we start participating, yes, they're going to steal the election this fall. No doubt about it. They're going to steal 5 million votes. What do? We get 6 million votes. We'll see, and we'll win. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Me and my gang. Daisy Duke denim, banging on gongs and singing our songs. Dude named Bill Rock jamming on an iPod. Beer and bonfires, wide open throttle, cores in a bottle. It's all for one and one for all, y'all. It's a brother and a sister kind of thing. Raise up your hand.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, if you want to hang out with me and my gang on, let's see, what's the date here? It's not listed on this thing. This makes me crazy. Ah, July 31st. That's a Monday night, a week from Monday. Monday night in Seattle at 7 p.m. I will be emceeing a gig, a fundraising gig for Congressman Jim McDermott with former President Bill Clinton. So if you're in Seattle or if you want to go to Seattle, check it out. The website is, this is for Congressman Jim McDermott. It's McDermottForCongress.com is the website. McDermott, McDermott, ForCongress.com. And as I said, it's a fundraiser, so, you know, there's a fee for the tickets. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a hoot. Jim McDermott, Bill Clinton, and yours truly. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone, and that'll be on July 31st. 866-440-8466, our telephone number, Steve in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Usually I'm at work, so it's a kind of a treat for me to be able to catch your show.
Thank you.
Well, real quick, the thing that's kind of making me nervous is there's all these polls out there that show that people across the country, by, you know, a pretty healthy margin, are saying that they really want the Democrats to control Congress. But then when you look at polls for individual candidates or who the representative is in their particular district, then the Dems don't do so well when they're looking at a particular candidate. And, yeah, that makes me really nervous.
Yeah, part of this has to do with gerrymandering. What has happened is that the district lines have been drawn in such a way that right now for the Democrats to control Congress, they would have to win about 61%, if my recollections are correct, of all the votes for members of the House of Representatives, rather than 51%. Because what they've done is they basically ghettoized Democrats, you know, Democratic voting areas, and also separated the Republican voting areas, but some of the larger districts, in fact, are the Democratic areas. So you end up with a smaller, if 60% of Americans were to vote for a Democrat, you would still have Republican control in the House of Representatives. You'd have to get 61 or 62%, as I recall.
Right.
And this is what Tom DeLay, and this is nothing new, of course. I mean, it goes back to the late 19th century. But Tom DeLay really turned this thing into an art form in Texas, for which he's being prosecuted right now. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court said that it has to stand. And it was done in Colorado. It's being done in half a dozen other states. And it ain't good.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Tom DeLay. There's a story that was in the news just, I think, yesterday. His old PAC has been dismantled. Are you familiar?
It was disbanded as of this week, wasn't it?
I believe it was this week. And my understanding is that that's basically the reason DeLay became as powerful as he was, which was he could distribute a lot of money to a lot of congressmen. And I was saying to some of my friends that this could be a good thing if basically they've just had a bunch of their money cut out from underneath of them.
Well, what's happened is that John Bonner has kind of reinvented the thing, and you know, in a slightly different way. But this is also something that is not unique to the Republicans. I mean, keep in mind PAC for a Change, Barbara Boxer's PAC. I mean, there are a number of these things out there. Hillary Clinton has one, and you know, where they kind of basically spread money among each other and that kind of thing. I'm of the opinion that we need to just get the money out of the system altogether. We need to go to publicly financed elections. If every American put in $5 a year on their, along with their income tax, if every American who works put in $5 a year, we would have enough money to fund all of the elections. And you combine that with a ban on political advertising on television, and I know that's not going to make me, you know, the TV industry real happy with me, but a ban on political advertising on television and a requirement that television and radio carry political candidates a certain number of hours each month in the months leading up to an election, so that we actually go back to the days when we heard from the political candidates in a meaningful way. And I think that we could restore something that resembles democracy in the United States.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, I just one last thing, and then I'll free up your phone line here. Is when you're talking with Bernie, you're absolutely right. People need to get out there, and I think there's a big disconnect. A lot of people, you know, may vote every 4 years, but they're disconnected from the party. And you know, getting involved in doorbelling, you know, sometimes it can be a real chore. I was just doing it last Sunday, but, you know, that is just, you know, a lot of people say that that is how you get the numbers showing up at the polls that
That's
we need
right.
to see, is you got to
right.
get out there, knock on door, you know, and, you know, just
And,
get
and
those
this is what,
motivated.
Yep, and this is what Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell and Pat Buchanan were doing back in the early 70s to take over the Republican Party, and they
right.
succeeded, and progressives need to take back the Democratic Party. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Great
Thank
to hear
you.
From you. And moving from Steve right to Roy in Rio Rancho, who's one of those guys who actually got out there and helped take back his local Democratic Party, didn't you, Roy?
Hey, we're having a good time, Tom.
Roy, if you wouldn't mind, just giving our listeners, it's been a long time since you've told your story on this program, just a 15, 20-second snapshot of how you got involved.
Well, I was a registered Republican because I was a moderate Republican. I bounced both ways, but in 2003, I got excited about Howard Dean. I changed my registration. I'm now the vice president of the Sandoval County Democratic Club because I got motivated. And we have just had more fun doing this. We had a great 4th of July parade a couple, 3 weeks ago. We got three or four couples that showed up at the next meeting. We've got probably about 70% of the elected officials of the Sandoval County Democratic Party are progressives. We kind of eased out the old guys, and some of the old guys have modified views. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just been fun. I mean, we're not done yet,
Yeah, but working inside
it'll never
the
be done yet. It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
And it is work, and it's frustrating at times, but then sometimes we get some good things and makes you feel good.
What first got you going? You said in 2003 you changed. What first motivated you?
Well, Howard Dean was, I had to change registration so that I could
see, he was the guy that turned you on.
Democratic caucus.
Yeah.
And that was, I'd been leaning Democratic for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and it was just, nothing motivated me to change registration.
Mm.
But, and now I can't imagine ever voting for a Republican. I mean, even though we have a lousy Secretary of State candidate on the Democratic side, she helped, her incompetence allowed New Mexico to go blue.
Mm.
But she's going to be better than the best that the Republicans can throw out there. So,
yeah. Well, I'm
not going to work very hard for her, but I'm sure going to work hard for the AG so he can keep a good eye on her.
Good on you. So, Roy, that's not what you called about.
The reason that I called was Halliburton Heather Wilson is awfully scared about Patricia Madrid, because last Friday, late Friday night, the first negative ad already ran, and this is what, 120 days or 110 days out from the election.
Now, Heather Wilson, Heather Wilson is your member of Congress, isn't she?
Right.
Yeah, she's the Republican member of Congress from your area.
And she has done one of these beautiful things of being able to, once in a great while, vote against something. But it was always on things that got defeated or that got passed by a greater margin than she, her vote didn't count.
So she could claim the vote later.
She voted against it.
Yeah.
So she has this illusion of somewhat independence. But when you go back and look at it, she's got a 90-plus agreement with Tom DeLay and George Bush.
We have the same thing here in Oregon with Gordon Smith. I mean, the local newspaper even used to preface his title with the word moderate. Moderate Republican Gordon Smith, blah, de, blah, de, blah. And you look at his voting record, and he's right there with the right-wing extremists virtually all the time. Every now and then, you know, he'd vote in the middle or take a position in the middle, particularly where he knew he was going to lose so he could say he took it. But, yeah, there's Republicans like that all over the country, chameleon Republicans.
One of the reasons that I called, though, I wanted to mention this ad was so classic because it's slow motion black and white. It's the old Willie Horton anchoring ad.
Hmm.
And I called kind of to get the idea out there. So as people see the ads come up, I'd love to see if there's some of this trend of those old black and white negative Willie Horton anchored ads.
This was an ad run by a Democrat against a Republican, or the other way around?
No, this the other way around. Heather Wilson is running against Patsy Madrid. She's already dumped the negative ads out there.
She's already, oh, holy cow.
We're 110 days away from the election?
Well, the first rule of politics is define your opponent before they can define themselves. And if her opponent is not that well known, she's going to try and define her.
Well, Patsy Madrid, fortunately, was the attorney general, and it's going to be a dogfight, and it's going to go right down, and it'll be into recounts. I absolutely have no doubt that we'll go recount in New Mexico, and hopefully we can hold it this time. Mark Chrisman Miller had a great article up. It was all around the blog yesterday about getting ready for the November surprise. So,
oh yeah, absolutely. That's why I said, you know,
it's about the black and white ads. Just have them give you a call or email you, because I'd love to see some kind of trend. You know,
okay.
If it's going to be their strategy.
Yeah, if there are negative Republican ads being done in black and white, let us know, and we'll talk about that in more detail a little later on in the week or next week about, you know, the whole NLP side of that. Roy, thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And when the winds of empire have blown you to the grave, should I open up my arms to you? Are you worthy to be saved? My heaven's filled with children you killed along the way. I have no room for Caesars. This is judgment.
And welcome back, my friends. Truth in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks, by the way, so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, Clay Kaplis, Tim MacArthur, Lauren Kirshner, at Air America Radio, and to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. It is much appreciated. 1-866-440-8466, our number. Jason in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom Hartman. Yeah, I'm a 32-year-old man. I've traveled to quite a few places in the world, and I want to talk about just a few countries and their healthcare systems. I've been to Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And I have to say, I like Australia's the best because they seem to have kind of a best of both worlds system between the United States and England. They had publicly funded healthcare systems, but they also had supplemental insurance companies if you worked at a company.
Right. Most of them do. I mean, Germany has a system similar to that. The last time I was in Australia, I got real sick from food poisoning and just, you know, went into one of these doc-in-a-box clinics, you know, walk-in clinic, and boom, saw a doctor right away. The same thing
happened to me when I banged my knee in some coral after surfing. I got pretty good care, and they didn't charge me a dime for it. I asked, what do I owe you? And I'm kind of picturing something like that in America might be better, because what I didn't like about England's system, it seems like a lot of their technologies and procedures were a little old.
Well, I think the problem with the system in Great Britain is that it is not a single-payer system. It's actually and every time I say this, people jump all over me, but it is socialized medicine or a variation on it. And really in the United States, you know, we have both. We have a single-payer system. It's called Medicare. And we have a socialized medicine system. That is, the government owns the hospitals and hires the doctors. That's called the Veterans Administration, the VA hospital system. And so we have experience in this country with both systems. And I think that most people would agree that probably the Medicare system works better than the VA system. Although, you know, there's you can argue either one of them, but I think that the simple solution for the United States, and it's a very simple solution, is simply to say Medicare is now going to cover all Americans. Period. No matter how old you are, no matter what your condition is, no matter what, that's it. The end of the health insurance industry as we know it. Those people can go out, find jobs selling encyclopedias door to door. But it's over. It's now a and you know, if people want to have supplemental health care, or if you want to have, you know, health resorts or fancy high end places where you can go in and get a full body CAT scan for $5,000, fine. You know, you don't make that illegal. Canada actually flirted with that for a while. You know, they made those things illegal, and now they've said, okay, fine, that you can do that, you know, and we'll have a national health care system. And it works out well.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, Tom. Interesting health care topics. I love your show.
Indeed. Jason, thanks very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yeah, before I go on about my main topic, just to remind people that Aaron Russo's movie, America from Freedom to Fascism, will be coming out next week in limited theatrical release on Friday, July the 28th.
Have you seen it yet, Joe?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, I have not. I'm assuming it's as good as everything I'm hearing from everybody who has.
Oh, it's a great movie. It'll be on places like Kansas City, Missouri, Austin, Texas, Tampa, Florida, New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles.
Great.
Those places people can see it next week.
Great.
But I want to talk about the United States Senate race in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And to paraphrase FDR, the Democrats have nothing to fear but Joe Lieberman himself.
There's a lot of Democrats who agree with you, Joe.
Yeah. You know, because like I told you, the brief time I got to talk to you about this subject, the last time, the Republican candidate doesn't have a chance in hell of winning. And another thing about Joe Lieberman, you might remember 6 years ago when he was Gore's running mate, he was running for re-election to the United States Senate back then. And I think that might have had something to do with the fact that he was one of those Democratic senators that did not step up to the plate to demand a recount, you know, or whatever there. You know, when the election got stolen from Al Gore because he was worried about his own political career.
Oh, absolutely. And Joe Lieberman was one of the guys who was leading, I don't want to say leading the impeachment of Bill Clinton, but, you know, he was the first Democrat, as I recall, to speak out and condemn Clinton and say, yes, this is a great moral issue, blah, 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 blah. I mean, you know, on that. In fact, I think that's why Al Gore picked him, is he wanted somebody who could get him as far away from Bill Clinton and his sex life as possible. And Joe Lieberman was the Democrat who had been outspoken in his criticism of Clinton, which is what amazes me. I mean, Clinton is going to be campaigning for Joe Lieberman when Lieberman just stuck the knife in his back, you know, when he really needed him. I think it's tragic. But number one, Joe Lieberman, you know, pushing for, you know, he voted against like the bankruptcy bill, but then he wouldn't vote to stop the filibuster. I mean, over and over and over again, when it really counted, Lieberman was with the Republicans.
Well, he was one of the co-founders of the DLC.
Yeah. So I didn't know that, but I'm assuming that that's probably the case because he's certainly, you know, in that, you know, philosophically in that area. Joe, thanks for the call and thanks for pointing that out. Will in Pittsburgh. Hey, Will, we've just got a few seconds left before we've got to wrap it up.
Well, I'll call you back next week, but I'll tell you this. You know, the Democrats are going down big time again, slam dunk.
Anyway, going down, you think, in 2006?
Oh, my God, yeah. Who are they going to trot out? Another hoodlum?
Well, the Democrats have a lot of very good candidates, Will.
Well, we can get into this next week, but I did want to ask you something. The two ladies, one was it Congressman Shirley Chisholm, and who was the other wonderful lady? She was also black from Texas. Do you remember Vernon something?
No, I'm sorry, Will. You're beyond my current institutional memory. But as you said, we will talk about it next week. Coming up on Monday's program, I'll be debating conservative Alex Epstein, who claims that a victory for big tobacco is a victory for the rule of law. Yeah? Judah Fried has created a modern update of Thomas Paine's Common Sense called Global Sense. He'll be with us. And stay tuned for our Bad Boss Contest. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Remember, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.